This is a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes with Lee Harris. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robinson.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I have the amazingly fabulous honor to share the microphone with some really great and talented people. And today is a little bit of a treat. It's going to be a little bit different.
Indeed. Indeed. It's International Day here at the Roundtable Podcast. And Brian, I just wanted to say just real quick,
yep.
You know, I realized that, you know, for this is, I think, our 12th or 13th episode.
Right.
And for every one of these, I've been like building up to our guest host as though nobody knew who it was.
Right.
I'm being all coy. And I just realized today as I was clicking on our episodes that the name of the guest host is right there. So everyone is well aware that
I didn't even think about that. That's
you know,
funny.
I'm sitting here thinking we're building the drama and everybody's going, dude, get on with it. Oh, my
God. You know what,
though?
You're so dramatic yourself that even though they already know the name, I'm sure that they forget it just for the excitement of having the drama.
They get swept up in the drama of it all. Yeah.
So go ahead and build the drama because you're good.
Ladies and gentlemen, our guest host for 20 Minutes With is a most distinguished gentleman. Not only is he the chair of the British Fantasy Society, which I can't say without letting at least a little bit of a dialect creep in, the British Fantasy Society, which just holds all sorts of awesomeness in my heart. He's also the instigator of the Hub Fiction e-zine, which for a while there was a blazing comet in the firmament of sci-fi fiction, stumbled briefly through a dark nebula. And thanks to the efforts of our guest host and Al Stewart, is coming back to life, resurrected from the dark, cold grave of space to reinvest and reinfuse the world with awesome sci-fi fiction. So do check out hubfiction.com. But perhaps the awesomest of all is that he is the editor at Angry Robot Books, which, if you don't know who they are, what rock have you been living under? If nothing else, their book covers are the most stunning art pieces you've ever seen. Their sections are broken up into SF, F, and WTF, which is beyond awesome in my book, because spec fic, yeah, it is what the fuck. Who knows? And they embrace that greatly. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm and delight. What kind of welcome is it going to be? It's going to be a warm and roundtable podcast welcome to our guest host, Lee Harris. Lee, I know you have so much going on. Thank you for joining us for this episode of 20 Minutes With.
Actually, view of the requirements to up the drama, I have to tell you that Lee wasn't able to make it today. thank you, Brian. Yeah, that was probably the nicest and most inaccurate introduction I think I've ever had. Certainly, I do all those things, but you built me up to such an extent that I fear the rest of this podcast is going to be a sore disappointment for anybody listening.
Well, and okay, well, let's dig into this then. And you're not the first person to say that, Lee. And I realize that I have...
Somebody knew I was coming, did they?
Yes. Well, I have emails I'll share. But Brian and I came into this very wide-eyed and innocent as fans of spec fic, of science fiction, of fantasy. People that not only... We don't just pick up a book and enjoy it, but we really immerse ourselves in it. And we both are writers in some degree or another. Brian's farther along that road than I am. But we hold the people that create these books or have a hand in these books in incredibly high esteem. And I can't believe that we're the only ones that hear about talking to the editor of Angry Robot Books or talking to Mer Lafferty or the voice of Pseudopod and don't get a little bit of a thrill. Is this the first time that you've run into someone who has a Gurmi fanboy fixation on the awesomeness of what you do?
It's not the first time, okay. But it surprises me every time it happens. And you know, I'm a very, very small part of the SF scene. There are giants that astride the earth like a colossus. I had a very, very good friend of mine, and I were chatting at World Horror Con. It's standing in the corner of the bar. This is World Horror Con 2 years ago, I think it might have been, in Brighton, in the south of England. And we were chatting in the corner of the bar, and who should walk over but Mr. Neil Gaiman, because Neil knew my friend Sarah and came over to say hello. So the three of us were chatting there for a while, and a young man started walking over. It must have been in his early 30s, and it became evident that all he wanted to say was, "Hello, Neil. I just wanted to say hello and thank you for the books. I love what you do." He stood there and he said, "Hi, Neil. Hi, I really and as it transpired, he wasn't a stutterer. He was just a man who was meeting his idol. He was meeting his deity. And to see somebody at Neil's level and the amount of you use the word esteem for the, you know, this was almost religious in its extent. Right. It fascinates me. It really, really does. And I don't get that, and I never expect to get that, because I'm one of the guys that works behind the scenes, and you know the authors are the ones that quite rightly should get all of this adulation.
Do you have anybody that you hold in such high regard that they would reduce you to a sweating pile of stuttering flesh if they came up to you?
I don't usually get the those sort of reactions. I was working as an editor, you know, in my long, dim and distant past, I was a professional actor for a number of years, and I've never...
Which I love, by the way. Instantly elevates... Go ahead, I'm sorry, carry on.
But I've never really, really had that situation where I was afraid to go over and say hello to somebody or got in such... tied myself in such knots, except at that same convention at World Horror Con in Brighton, one of the guests of honor there was James Herbert. Now James Herbert's books are pulp horror novels generally, but pulp horror novels of the highest order. And although he's not the greatest writer in the world, his novels helped me through my childhood. And he was sitting on a small sofa, 8 feet to my right, with a bottle of absinthe in front of him. And I couldn't bring myself to go over and say, "Hello, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate what you did for me during my childhood. You got me through many years of adolescence, and your books really, really helped me." And I just wanted to go and say that. And I know dozens, scores, hundreds of writers. I know that his reaction would be, "Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you." But I couldn't bring myself to do it. And that's the only time that's ever happened to me. So I do understand what this chap was going through. But I still find it fascinating. I found it fascinating in myself.
I do too. I do too, especially being on the other end of that and examining and discovering, as you no doubt have as well, that these people that we revere and idolize are human beings and are often don't feel worthy of that adulation that we have invested in them for years. Mm. So that actually raises another question that I wanted to put to you, Lee. Friends, if anybody goes out to Lee's literary alchemist profile up on the website, which will be up by the time this podcast airs, you'll see that Lee has a diverse set of favorites that run the gamut from comics to fantasy to sci-fi. And Lee, I wanted to ask you, and this is a question that I've asked several, and I'm always intrigued by the response. What is it about speculative fiction, and by that I mean it in its broadest and most encompassing sense, that draws you, that what is it about the stories of specfic, of fantasy, sci-fi, steampunk, whatever, that make them more relevant, that capture your imagination and your heart so much more than other books in other genres?
That's such a difficult question.
I know, I'm sorry.
And I hate you for
yes.
it.
Yes.
I grew up reading a wide range of novels, short stories, novellas, comics, and I found myself getting drawn more and more to science fiction and fantasy to an extent, and horror to a very great extent, and didn't realize until several years later that somehow my reading had narrowed, and I was only reading science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Huh. That was dangerous, I think, because I always enjoyed reading quite widely. And to suddenly find that I'd almost read myself into a ghetto, although or a fabulous ghetto it is, it was a surprise. And I've never, perhaps I should have, I've never really sat back and analysed why that happened. I don't know whether it was a cultural thing. I don't know whether it was a peer-driven thing. I guess a lot of my friends were reading these sorts of books. Not all of them read, but they were reading these sorts of books. They were watching these sort of TV programs and films. But I've had to make a very conscious effort over the last few years to try to read outside the genre, because as fabulous as the genre is, and of course it's fabulous, that's the whole reason I'm here talking to you today. it's not everything. It's there are other books out there to read. There are other films out there to watch. But I still find myself drawn more and more back to science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And when I discover what it is, then I will perhaps drop you a line and let you know what my discovery is. And
I'd appreciate that.
But I don't know. I don't know. Fabulousness of the genre.
It is. Let's take it from a different perspective then. What is it that you see the genre adding to the world? What value do you see? I mean, obviously, anything that involves this much effort and passion and joy and love must be adding and infusing something into the world that has benefit or merit. What do you think that is in the context of specfic genre?
I think part of it is that it allows us to forget about real life for a second. Now, all good literature does that, but I think in terms of science fiction and fantasy and horror, that it's an extra step outside our normal day-to-day mundane lives. Not that I'm saying that your lives are day-to-day and mundane. I'm sure they're every bit as fabulous as we all imagine they are. But I think taking an extra step outside what is the usual. I think that there's a great line I'm paraphrasing from Marvin, the paranoid android, in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when he's asked if he reads fiction. He says, "Well, real life is bad enough. Why do I want more of it?" What science fiction gives us is more of it, but more of something very, very different, so that we don't have to experience what we already experience on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
Excellent.
To kind of expand that even further, it seems to me that there's been kind of a boom in urban fantasy. Mm. Things like Jim Butcher's Dresden Files and, yep. even things like Twilight, and I think you might even be able to categorize Harry Potter in that. Chuck Wendig, totally, yeah. Right? So that it's now our current real world with those fantasy elements infused in it. Do you think that as a genre is sustainable? And what do you think the draw is to that?
I think it's very much sustainable. I think any genre is sustainable if you have good writers working in it. You mentioned Chuck, you mentioned Jim Butcher and all of the other great writers that are out there, Neil Gaiman, of course, that we talked about earlier, plenty of very, very good writers writing in this subgenre. I think the draw, I think part of the draw is that it's a very easy way for people who have not necessarily experienced a lot of science fiction fantasy. It's a very easy way for them to be introduced to our world because right. it's their world just twisted through 23 degrees. And, you know, they already recognize the places, they already recognize the people, but there's just something slightly different about what's going on. The thing that urban fantasy has to have going for it is a good urban environment. So we're talking about cities that people already live in. Urban fantasy doesn't work quite as well if you invent the locale. So you have things good like Mike Carey's Felix Custer books, which is very, very much set in a recognizable London. You have the Charlie Houston's Joe Pitt books. You mentioned the Jim Butcher books, mm-hmm. very, very recognizable geographical locations, which people who know them either personally or through television can immediately recognize what's going on, who the people are, what the politics are. But right. you add in then, oh, well, vampires are here and everybody knows about it, or ghosts have started rising, then it becomes very interesting. But in terms of sustainability, as long as you have good writers working in the genre, it will always be sustainable.
Sure. Well, and the beauty of urban fantasy is that you get all of, as you say, all of the juicy goodness of a fantastic setting, whether it's vampires or dragons or fairies or whatever. But after the reader puts the book down and starts walking down the street, the possibility of every corner you haven't turned mm-hmm. down suddenly can be that fantasy. Yes. It really makes it almost touchable in your real life,
and a good novel will touch somebody like that. And and I don't know whether I'm unique in science fiction and fantasy in that every now and then I look at a light and try to switch it off, and it never happens.
With your mind?
With my mind.
Yes, absolutely.
But someday it's got to happen at some point for someone. Why not?
Yeah.
Me?
Right. Yeah.
So it's opening up your mind to the possibilities.
Yep. We'll be back with more of 20 Minutes with Lee Harris after this brief promotional break.
Good Lord, is there no end to these lost cases?
We did make a dent.
A dent? Wellie, it's more like we're trying to lower the Thames a teaspoon at a time.
But consider what we have learned in the process and what new mysteries await us. Here's the case of a mythical creature of Siam coming to the aid of the ministry. Here's another set in your native country of New Zealand that tells of an ancient holy man waking a dragon. And here is an intriguing case of a strange series of heists corresponding with a traveling festival.
Well, since you put it that way, let us proceed. Testing, testing.
Miss Braun? Exactly what are you intending to do with that micro? Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
We have talked about this.
And now we're going to podcast it.
Again?
Again.
Tales in the Archives, Volume 2.
The second season of the award-nominated podcast from Pip Ballantyne and T. Morris.
Subscribe for free through iTunes or at the Ministry of Peculiar Currents' website.
Or visit the Kindle store at Amazon.com, the Nook store at BarnesandNoble.com, or smashwords.com for 99-cent editions of these original shorts.
Find out more at ministryofpeculiaroccurrences.com.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Lee Harris.
I have a question that Dave might yell at me at because it gets away from the writer and more to the reader, but this is just a very quick little personal inquiry. Do you as an editor see any difference in the shift of readership depending on, things like economic conditions or if life suddenly becomes a lot more difficult? Do you see people shifting away from literary fiction and maybe a boost in fantasy where people are just trying to escape? Is there anything like that?
I don't think so, no. Okay. I would like to think so because the more people that move away from literary fiction and into science fiction fantasy means the longer I'll be in work.
Right.
So engineering an economic collapse is in your future then, Evil Genius.
Well, yes, hang on, I'm just making a few notes here. I don't think that's the case. I mean, literary fiction is by far the best selling genre, if at all genre you can describe it as. And we in the science fiction and fantasy community will forever, I think, be lesser read in terms of numbers of people reading us. But I don't think that economic situations have much say in what people read, just in how much they read and how they read it.
Right.
I have one last question because our 20-minute clock is ticking down, and this is almost certainly going to take us over the 20 minutes, but maybe not by much. Lee, for our listeners out there who are contemplating or working up the courage or are just burgeoning onto the, I'm getting ready to submit my manuscript to a publisher, would you share with them what it is that you look for when you are reading a book? Someone, your slush pile reader has handed you a book and you read it. What is it about the book? If it's a book that you're going to accept, what qualities do you look for in that book? What is it in that book that makes you go, yes, this is the text. I'm so all over this.
Okay. Well, before I answer that, I'll answer something that's just a slight tangent to that. Mm-hmm. If anybody is planning to submit their book to a publisher or to an agent, the biggest favor you can do yourself is read the bloody submission guidelines, for God's sake.
I was listening to the Angry Robots podcast about the Batman fanfic that was submitted to the fantasy line.
Yes, we asked for fantasy, classic fantasy novels, so Sword and Sorcery, Kingdom Fantasy, that sort of thing. Classic fantasy novels of between 90,000 and 140,000 words, and although there was some leeway there. And in fact, in order to upload the manuscript, you have to tick a box to say this novel is classic fantasy. And good luck to the person who submitted a 50,000-word Batman fanfic.
Which lied.
Was written as a sequel to the second Chris Nolan movie. Not quite sure what he thought was going to happen with that. He did send through three other novels at the same time, and unfortunately, all four novels were rejected and read. If you can't follow something as simple as submissions guideline, if you indeed ignore the submissions guideline and think, well, these don't apply to me, then you're really not going to get very far. Now, sometimes we put these submission guidelines in for they're always in for very good reasons. And sometimes we're saying this is the type of book we're looking for. If you submit a different type of book, you're going to get rejected. But also, of course, it gives the publisher or the agent, these rules apply equally to agents, it gives the publisher or the agent the opportunity to say, this person is a fucking idiot. I do not want to work with them. If you're going to be submitting to an agent or to a publisher, you need to stop doing stupid things. You need to give yourself every opportunity to succeed. Ignoring the guidelines is going to mean that you fall at the first hurdle. It means that your manuscript's not even going to get read. Right. Now, you may have worked for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years or more on your first novel. And the fact that you've put down 50,000 or 100,000 or 150,000 words down on paper or on screen is a fantastic achievement. I've not been able to do that. I have every respect for somebody who can. But if you're going to put in that much effort, why waste it by doing something stupid at the last minute? And that doesn't just go for the writer of the Batman fanfic. His other three novels may have been absolutely ideal for us. They may have been 140,000 word classic fantasies that would have rocked the fantasy world. We'll never know. And he'll never know if we like them because he did something silly. That's an extreme example, but it's a real example.
Oh, plus, his name now is stuck in your head. So anything, if you do that once and you become recognized as not following the rules so blatantly, I mean, that's going to shadow you at that publisher for years.
Right. Yeah, publisher, but anywhere that agent or that
good point.
Editor works in future as well.
Yep.
Now, is that common? I mean, I hear that a lot, and I read that a lot. That if you do something that that sets you apart, where you make yourself known as somebody not to work with, how much does that ruin your reputation in the entire community? Like, do you guys, you know,
we don't tend to share the names of these people. We, you know, we don't sit in the corners of bar giggling. Well, we do sit in the corners of the bar giggling because half the time we're drunk, which you see it as a convention. But we don't sit in the corners of the bar conspiring against the writing community because we love the writing community. We want good writers. We want good stories.
Absolutely.
You know, contrary to popular opinion, we don't want to reject any of the manuscripts that come into us because we want every manuscript that comes in to be excellent. We want every manuscript that comes in to be the best thing we've ever read, and we want to publish every manuscript that comes in. Unfortunately, not all of them are good enough. The ones that are good enough, not all of them are what we're looking for. Some of them may be excellent, but we have too much of that sort of thing on our list. But it's also, of course, you know, we get hundreds of these things coming through, and we only have the opportunity to publish a very small percentage of them. So what you need to do as a writer is give yourself and give your manuscript the very best chance it can possibly have. And the very best chance it can possibly have is do what the publisher says or the agent says they're looking for. You know, last year, we ran, as a publisher, we only accept manuscripts through agents generally. Last year, we tried something which we called our Open Door Month. And in March of last year, we said, right, for the entire month of March, if you're an unagented author, then we're going to give you a shot. We're opening our doors to you, and we'd love to see what you've got. Completed novels only, please. We're only interested in books that have already been written. And during that month, we had 994 submissions.
Oh, wow. Man.
It's about 33 a day.
And, jeez Louise. The mailman must have loved you.
Well, we only accept electronic, so yes.
Oh, duh. There you go.
The email man must have loved us. But we rejected around 15% of those simply because they didn't follow the submission guidelines. Right. Now, I know somebody who once said that his boss, when he was interviewing people, would take the list of CVs, resumes that he'd received, and grab the top half and put them straight in the bin. And wow. He'd say, well, they were unlucky, and I don't work with unlucky people.
Oh, man.
that's extreme. We don't do that. But what we do is we say, well, if this person is not capable of following fairly straightforward guidelines, or are capable but feels they're better than that, then you know there are 85% of the rest of the submissions pile are doing it right. What you know they need a shot. So you know that was a very long. Sidebar. I apologize for that, but read the submission guidelines. Don't just read them; follow them.
Right, like the Bible.
Yes, exactly. And, I mean, a good agent, a good publisher, will have very, very straightforward and easy to follow guidelines on their website. And if they don't have guidelines on their website, and they are open to submission, then you should ask.
Out of curiosity, Lee, of that almost 1,000 submissions that you got, do you know how many you've actually accepted and are publishing?
Yes, we've taken 6 authors out of that list, 2 novels apiece. No, in fact, 3 novels from one of them. So we've out of last year's Open Door Month, we've bought a minimum of 13 books.
Wow! Well, congratulations to those 6, and that's about consistent with the odds. if you're strictly playing the odds that writers tend to be confronted with when they work that route.
Right. Now, as we record this, we're actually 2 days away from the end of our second open door period.
Wow!
And it was so successful last year, we decided to repeat it. We put in some different guidelines this time around. And if you're listening to this and you're interested in the open door, I'm afraid you've missed it. It finished a little under 3 weeks ago. But at the time of recording this, our 2-week open door period this time. We've so far received 462 submissions. Wow. 148 for Angry Robot, because we said this time around we're only looking for classic fantasy, and right. 314 for Strange Chemistry, our YA imprint, which launches in September, that's about what we were expecting to get. So we're very, very pleased with that, and 2 more days to go, and I would imagine we'll have a bit of a last minute rush coming in as well. Sure. So I would expect that to top 550, 600. in 2 weeks.
Is that going to be an annual experience for Angry Robots? You're going
to
be.
I am not going to commit to that.
March on my calendar.
We found six authors last year, and we found six debut authors last year. We are giving six people the first step on their literary career.
That's huge.
And it's huge. And you know, this is something we do all the time. We publish books month in, month out, and we don't take for granted the fact that we're, quite a number of cases, we're responsible, not just us, every publisher out there, we're responsible for starting somebody's career. And it's an important and it's a very humbling thing. Right. But getting back to your actual question, what do I look for in a manuscript? Well, there are two editors, or there are two people within Angry Robot that edit, in addition to another one for Strange Chemistry and another one for our new crime imprint, which launches next spring, Exhibit A. But one of us, I look for primarily strong characters first, followed by story and plot. And my colleague looks for strong story and plot first, followed by strong characters. So that just shows you that even within the same publishing house, people will be looking for different things. So the best thing to do, really, is to make sure that you have a story with strong characters and story and plot. There we are, sorted. It's actually a very, very easy thing to get yourself published by any of the mainstream publishers. People think it's difficult. It's not. It's very easy. All you have to do is write a really good book and be really lucky. I said it was easy. I didn't say it was common.
I love it. Right.
Easy peasy. And you know, one of the best ways to come up with a sterling plot is to workshop your story with a podcast, for example.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Do you have any specific things in mind there, Dave?
I'm just lashing our name inextricably with Angry Robots from here forth. So,
So Angry Robots wholly endorses the Square Table podcast. That's what you guys are called, isn't it?
See, I was hearing soundbite right there. I'm going, oh yes, I'm going to put that in a promo. Oh crap!
Oh boy.
I may yet, just cause.
We'll just change our name today, and then we have a good.
Well, ask me some questions with the word where the answer has to have the words round and table in there, and you've already got podcast and endorses.
Exactly. Well, and we just did. We just got that. Awesome.
Oh no.
Ha ha, you've fallen into my net of deceit and treachery.
Yeah, and you're off the blacklist.
I had nothing to do with that.
That's right. I don't know this man. That's right. Dave Robinson's name goes out to all publishers with a red flag. Awesome. Well, we've extended past our 20 minutes, and I am so glad that we did. Lee, thank you so much. I think there's a lot here that certainly Brian and I can take away from, hopefully our listeners will as well. So we appreciate you taking the time and sharing so generously of your insights. It means a lot.
Dave, Brian, I had a good time, and I didn't expect to because I've spoken to other people that have been on this show, and they were wrong. What they were telling me was wrong.
I'm so glad to hear that. And if you'd email me that list, I'd like to hire some of those assassins that work for Angry Robots.
Oh, we have some Angry Robots rather than assassins. They're far more discreet.
And reliable. Yes, absolutely. Good point. All right. Brian, anything else before we wrap up, bud?
I think everything's been said. Well, no, actually I don't, because we could go on like this for another hour and a half. But,
oh, my goodness, yes.
Lee, thank you very much for coming on. This was fabulous, and I've been taking copious notes so that I know what to do next March or April.
And there goes that Batman fanfic draft you were working on.
That's right.
Well, and we wish you, Lee, and Angry Robots every success.
Thank you, guys, and right back at you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Excellent. Friends, thank you so much for tuning in, whether it's the day this episode dropped or 5 years from now. I'm looking right at you. Thank you. We appreciate it. That's the whole reason Brian and I do this. So do stay tuned. In a few days, we'll have a workshop episode with Master Lee Harris, and workshopping a sci-fi, possibly romance novel. I'm not sure. But we shall see, and it's destined to be awesome. So until then, take care of yourselves. Brian, what's the suggestion?
Go write.
Absolutely. Ideas are cheap. Turn them into stories, folks. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.